Now I grew up down an old dirt road in a town you wouldn't know. I still live in the sticks where you wouldn't go, in a town of 1200 off an old dirt road, and a country boy is all I'll ever be.
What's going on, everybody, and welcome back to the Mountain Man Dan Show. Been another crazy week here. Been working on getting firewood and getting moved out of the shop I've been running. I mentioned running a shop this winter, and the owner had something come up, and I had to get moved out of there a little sooner than I wanted to, and we came to an agreement. It's all right. It is what it is. It's getting close to springtime. But I've been recording this podcast over at the shop, so I'll have to find a new spot to record that won't annoy the wife too badly, since she doesn't like having to be quiet for an hour or better while I record the show. And I don't blame her. You know, we live in a small cabin here. So I might end up recording out in the camper since it's starting to warm up, but we'll just have to see how that goes. Today, I'm recording this episode in our living room. So I'm going to apologize in advance if there's any background noise with the dogs and that kind of stuff. Not a whole lot I can do about it. I've got the gain turned down on this mic. But if I turn it down too much, my voice will start to get more fuzzy than usual. Over at the shop, there was a lot of echo, so it was pretty bad, even with the gain turned down real low. So I'm hoping this one will turn out okay. We'll just have to kind of see where it goes as I record, and when I go to edit it, see how much I can edit out. So, yeah, I had an incident with my carry gun this week, which just goes and proves the point I'm always making of checking your carry gun daily and shooting it often. I was out getting a load of wood this week, and I'd finished off a Coke or an energy drink or something. So I took the can and I chucked it out along the edge of the road over there as far as I could. No, there's nothing back there for 400 miles, so I can shoot back there no problem. And I figured I'd take a couple pops out of it with my carry gun, which I was carrying the Springfield 10mm. And I pulled the gun out, lined up the sights, and started squeezing the trigger, and I just kept squeezing and squeezing harder, and nothing, the gun wouldn't go off. So something went wrong with the trigger, and it's just not going off every time you pull the trigger. Sometimes it will, sometimes it won't. I'm not sure if it's something with the trigger or if it's something to do with the grip safety, but it's not working the way it's supposed to. Something ain't right with it. So I'm debating ordering a aftermarket trigger kit for it, maybe like I think Powder River or somebody like that offers aftermarket trigger groups for them for the elites, because they're not the same as the standards. Or maybe I'll just send it back to Springfield. I haven't made up my mind yet as what I'm going to do there. And I haven't had time to contact Springfield this week either. I've been really busy. So for now, I'm back to carrying my Ruger Lightweight Commander 45, which has been a faithful companion in the past. This gun has a really nice set of Elkstag grips on it that David Alsup made before he passed away. And I debated pulling him off the gun if I'm going to go back to carrying it, but I think David would want me to carry the gun and use the grips, even if they do get a little bit beat up. So they're staying on the gun, and I'm going back to carrying that one for now. I lost the transmission on my plow truck this week. We had a couple nice days early in the week where it got up to about 40 above, and we got about 6 inches of wet, heavy snow, and while I was trying to plow out a friend's road, he's got a pretty long road, I developed a massive transmission leak. So I parked it, went and got the truck and trailer and towed it home. And the tranny's been having some issues for a while anyway. It doesn't like going in and staying in third gear. So I think I'm just going to park the truck until I have funds to have the transmission rebuilt later in the summer. Pretty close to spring right now, and I should be able to get by without it. If I do have to plow, I can go back to the way I used to do it. I still have the plow for the four-wheeler. I did that for 3 years here, so I can if I have to. Don't really want to, but close enough to spring I can get by. Other than that, not much going on here. I mentioned we had a couple of nice days early in the week, but back down to about 10 degrees now. I'm looking at the thermometer as I record this. It's 10 degrees. I mentioned last episode that I was getting it recorded earlier in the week, and that was a good thing, as this episode took more time than what I expected due to all the testing and the lack of time I had this week. And I'm once again going to be recording and editing right before Monday morning release. It's 10:30 right now, and I'm just sitting down to record this one. It's 10:30 Sunday night, and I'm just sitting down to record this one, and I still got to edit it and get it online. So it's going to be, I'm hoping to come up. I got to find a couple quick and easy subjects, though, you know, still entertaining and informative for the next couple weeks, and try to get a couple weeks ahead where I can, you know, record two or three episodes a week and get a couple episodes in advance, and then I can go back to these bigger subjects. I think I'm going to attempt to start putting the episodes on YouTube. Not this one. I was thinking about doing this one, but with losing the shop and everything, I just don't have a good place to record video also. But I've had several people ask if I was going to do that, and although I can't for the life of me figure out why anybody would want to see my ugly face and have to listen to me, I'm thinking I'm going to go ahead and try to put the show on YouTube. Unlike the podcast, where I edit out the pauses, the smoke, and bloopers, and whatever else to make the show better, the YouTube, if I do it, will be largely unedited for now. And probably not be the best video quality, since I'll be using the built-in camera on my computer, but I can't really afford to go out and buy a $200 camera for this either. Hopefully I'll be able to upgrade equipment at some time, including a better camera and a better mic that doesn't pick up all the background noise. This Blue Yeti is a condenser mic, and it's a really good mic. It's a top-shelf mic. I didn't know anything about them when I bought it, and it's not the best setup for my need because of it being a condenser mic. If I turn the gain way down like I normally do, and like I've got it right now, it makes, I mentioned before, it makes my voice just a little bit mumbled and fuzzy. And if I turn the gain up, and I can turn the gain up like that, and you guys will be able to hear me better, be more clear, but then I start getting pops, and of course background noise, anything in the background noise, it will pop, it'll come up really bad. This thing picks up every little noise, like, that's just me tapping my finger on the desk. I'm sure you guys can hear that, lightly tapping the desk, and I'm sure you guys can hear that. However, it's still better than trying to record using the game set. I used to have a gaming headset I used to record, and it's better than that. But I want to try to keep making the quality of the show better and the audio, and now video quality will be a big part of that. So now I'm going to take a pause to turn this gain back down. Okay, gain's turned back down. For now, the episodes will be posted on my YouTube channel, which is called The Shooter's Apprentice, which is the same as my other social media names. I've used that name since way before I started this show, and it comes from my background with my job working heavy construction. We always have apprentices on the job sites. And I'm always trying to learn more about shooting and guns from the older generation, so it seemed fitting. I'm considering changing the name of the show to match everything else now that I'm doing the show solo, or have to change the name of everything else so everything matches. If you guys want to send me some feedback on this, feel free to email me at dansgunstuff@gmail.com. And yes, that is another old email I had set up way back in the day when I first started my YouTube channel, and it was just called Dan's Gun Stuff. Unfortunately, I'm not planning to do a cigar review this week because of the uncertainty of where I'm going to be recording. It turned out I'm recording in the living room, so I can't smoke in here. Hopefully, wherever I set up to do shows in the future will be a place where I can smoke and enjoy a cigar. Okay, guys. Today's topic started out as a gear review, but the more I played with this concept again, I decided to go ahead and do a full episode on the subject. Since the dawn of time, man has tried to design more efficient ways to kill. Cain murdered Abel with a rock, but I'm sure as he bashed his brother's head in, he wished he had a Glock. Sorry, a little bit of dark humor there, but it drives home the point I'm trying to make. If it wasn't true, archery hunters would still be hunting with stone arrowheads, and not with these fancy broadheads that we see on the market today. This same story goes for firearm hunting. Every year, we see these new cartridges come to the market, and the manufacturers boast up to be all that much better than the cartridges that came out last year. The 22 long rifle has been around a long, long time, since 1987 as a matter of fact. Rimfires were quite common early on in the existence of the metallic metal cartridge, with the first being the 6mm Flobert introduced in 1945. This early rimfire cartridge was basically consisted of a percussion cap with a projectile attached to the end. This powderless cartridge fired a small lead round ball at about 700 feet per second and was mostly used in special guns for indoor shooting. The 22 rimfire, or later known as the 22 short, was introduced in 1857 in the first Smith & Wesson revolver. The 22 Short was the first American metallic cartridge. The initial loading of this cartridge fired a 29-grain bullet using 4 grains of black powder for a muzzle velocity of right around 850 feet per second. The quiet, low-recoil cartridge was and still is popular for various shooting sports, but has lost a lot of its flame to the 22 long rifle these days. The 22 long rifle uses the case of the 22 long combined with a 40-grain bullet, producing a longer cartridge than the 29-grain 22 long and a higher velocity. This pretty much rendered the 22 extra long cartridges obsolete, and the 22 long rifle is probably the most popular cartridge in existence today, chambered for every type of gun you can imagine. The cartridge utilizes a healed bullet, which means that the driving band of the bullet is the same diameter as the case, and that it has a smaller diameter heel that fits into the case. The cartridge originally used a 40-grain round nose bullet, but today we can find everything from 30-grain to 60-grain is pretty much readily available, with 36 and 40-grain being the most common, 36-grain mostly being hollow points. The initial black powder loading pushed a 40-grain bullet at just under 1,100 feet per second right thereabouts, I believe. The 22 has come a long way since 1887, with the modern 36-grain high-velocity loads pushing 36-grain copper-plated bullets at around 1,250 feet per second, and various other loads like the 32, the CCI Stinger pushing its 32-grain bullet at an advertised 1,640 feet per second. Or my favorite load, the CCI Velociter, which pushes a 40-grain bullet at an advertised 1,435 feet per second. I must have been about 14 the first time I tried this ammo, and it was amazed at how much better it killed game than the usual Federal bulk pack ammo I got as a kid. And this is what leads to today's topic of modifying 22 long rifle ammunition to be better for hunting. While modifying ammo to be more accurate for match shooting and even hand loading for this purpose is common, We're really going to focus on making it more efficient for hunting with this episode. The original 22 long rifle ammo used a 40-grain round nose bullet, and this loading is still very common today. And anyone who has ever shot very much small games knows that this round nose bullet is a bit unimpressive when it comes to killing power. I grew up in the last of the golden years of the cheap 22 ammo. My first 22 was a Savage Model 24 22 long rifle over 20 gauge. And that one was followed by an H&R 151 Leatherneck. I learned real quick that the semi-auto was real fun, but also costly to shoot. And the next 22 I remember getting at the age of 13 or so, I saved up for, and it's also the first gun I remember buying for myself, and I still have it, and that's my Zestaven Model CZ-99. There was a Marlin Model 60 in there somewhere too, and a Marlin Model 70, and a couple single sixes, and a Ruger Mark II bull barrel, all by the time I was 16 or so, and I shot all these guns a lot. I said this was in the last of the days of cheap 22 ammo, and living here in rural Alaska, there was no limits of places to hike and shoot things to shoot at. At the time, I was working in a farm loading hay bales for spending money. Most of the time, I got to spend that on 22 ammo. At the time, I could get 500-round bricks of Remington Thunderbolt or the Federal Champion or CCI Blazer for $9.99 at Down Under Guns in Fairbanks, which is about 2 hours away. But when Walmart opened up, they had those 550-round bulk packs of the Federal 36-grain hollow points for the same price. And that became my ammo of choice. And I'm not joking when I say the amount of that ammo that I shot is probably in the six-figure range. I shot a lot of small game with this ammo. And although it does have a tiny flat nose on it, the hollow point is pretty much non-existent, and they did not perform that much better than the round nose ammo, and nothing like the Stingers I was fond of at that time. But I couldn't justify spending $6 or $7 a box on Stingers when I get a whole brick of ammo for $10. Early methods of making the ammo more effective on small game were crude at best, attempting using a sharp knife to cut a cross in the tip, or things along that line. On the Federal ammo, I found a number one Phillips bit could be gently tapped into the hollow point and make a cross and open them up a bit, but there was no real consistency to it. Dad had a 22 250 traded to him that had a bad barrel, and he cut me off a short piece of this barrel and bored it out so that 22 cartridges fit into it with just a tiny bit of the tip sticking out, And this could be shaved off with a sharp pocket knife or filed down with a raker file is how I normally did it. I used that little tool enough with a file that eventually it was too short and a new one had to be made. And this leads up to the product I was going to do a gear review on, but led to this entire subject. While browsing the internet somewhere, I came across a device called a Little Gizzy, or Little Gizzy. There are a few different versions of this tool. The one I got is the newest version, which is a single piece versus the older two-piece version. The older version could be used like the old piece of barrel I had to trim the noses off of the cartridge. But remember, shaving off lead reduces the weight of the projectile. And generally, even if it does shoot a higher velocity, remember, weight generally makes better muzzle energy. Not, and shaving a grain or two off of a bullet isn't going to make that much of a difference, I'm just saying. This unit is about 1.25 inches around and 2 inches long, with a hole drilled through the middle and a recess for the rim on one, and as well as a little slot to remove the cartridges with your thumbnail. It comes with 3 punches, a hollow point, a big hollow point, and a flat nose punch. The tool is used by inserting a .22 long rifle cartridge into the end of the recess for the rim, and then putting your punch of choice in the other end. I use a small ball peen hammer to gently tap the punch down, but they recommend using a drill press or an arbor press, which would be better since you can use the built-in stop to set the level for the punch. I don't have a drill press, so I used 1/4 inch washers on the punches as spacers to set my depth. The smallest of the hollow point punches did not need a washer. The bigger punch I found needed 1 washer, and the flat nose punch needed 2 washers to make cartridges I am happy with. Paco Kelly sold a tool similar to this called the Accuizer about 20 years ago, but I've never been able to get my hands on one. From what I've read about his is there was no kind of shoulder on the punch, so the depth was fully controlled by either an arbor press with a stop or controlled and uniform hammer blows. I very much like the built-in stops on this unit as it makes very uniform cartridges every time. One of the side effects of this tool is that since it reforms a bullet, it tends to bump up the driving band of the bullet, and this is a good thing. I measured a handful of various .22 cartridges before running them through the tool, and the smallest measurement I found was 0.220 inch, and the largest was 0.223 inch. After running rounds through the tool, the driving band of the bullets measured exactly 223 on every single cartridge, no matter which punch I used. Since we're on the subject of modifying .22 long rifle cartridges, this is probably a good time to mention modifying them for accuracy. I'm not going to get into a lot of detail, but with the growing interest in long-range rimfire shooting, we're starting to see some interesting stuff on the market. I've seen these guys go as far as measuring the thickness of the rims to get more consistent ammo for higher accuracy at long range. There have been a few tools of the design of this that swage the bullet and make the more uniform cartridges, and in theory, this should improve accuracy. There is also empty Prime 22 cases available, and some of those match shooters use these to load their own more precise 22 long rifle ammo. My dad has actually played with this too, using 45 grain cast bullets with the case crimped into the gas check shank of the bullet. He said that his hand loads produce far superior accuracy at 100 yards out of his rifles. Cutting edge bullets offer some 50 grain solid copper high BC bullets designed to load into 22 long rifle cases. So you can get pretty crazy going down this modified 22 rabbit hole. I was worried that with these bumped up bullets that they would not feed well in autoloaders, but I tested the rounds in a Beretta 21A, FN-502, Ruger Mark IV, 2 different 10-22s, and a Mossberg Plinkster, and all of them ran the modified rounds flawlessly. My Browning BL-22 also fed all the modified rounds perfectly, and it has been picky feeding blunt-nosed bullets in the past. I'm guessing these rounds worked fine in it because of the shorter overall length on the modified rounds. And I need to make an edit here real quick. I wrote this while I was still doing testing, and at that time, it had fed everything fine. Testing more with that rifle, I did have a couple of feeding hang-ups with the bigger hollow point, but not that you could just jingle the lever and they'd go right in. But just a quick edit there, I did end up having just a hair feeding issue with the BL-22, but it is a little picky on what it will feed. While on the subject of bumping up the bullet, I should mention that the rounds modified in the Dew do have a slight increase in pressure. I chronographed several different modified loads in different guns and saw an average of 22 feet per second higher velocity with the modified loads, the highest load showing 31 feet per second higher velocity from a 20-inch barrel. However, it doesn't seem to be enough to affect the function of the gun, and I actually got velocity closer to meeting the advertised on the box, which I always find to be a little bit high compared to actual velocity when you chronograph. Modifying the rounds with this tool, the way I do it is pretty straightforward. I took a piece of 3-inch angle iron and I clamped it in my vise out in my shed, and I used that as my work platform. But I also modified a bunch of rounds at my desk here in the house, and I even used a small little scrap of 2x6 and set it in my lap and modified rounds while watching TV on the couch, much to the annoyance of my lovely wife. Working at a relaxed pace, it takes about 10 minutes to do a box of 50. I did find that certain ammo was a little bit more difficult to remove with just a thumbnail under the rim, so I found a T-handle Allen wrench that fits in the die, and I use it to push the cartridges out from the top if needed. Most quality ammo like CCI comes out quite easily. It was mostly the cheaper Plinky ammo I found to be a bit tighter fit. I also experimented with flattening the nose of the bullet first and then hitting him with a hollow point punch, but it's much more time consuming, so I pretty much just stuck with making existing hollow points bigger with the small punch and using the flat punch and a couple of washers for spacers to turn round nose flat nose. The Federal Champion 36 grain hollow copper plated hollow point that I shot boxes of as a teen has such a tiny hollow point that they can be converted to either flat nose or a better hollow point. However, rounds with the existing hollow points like the CCI mini mags I pretty much only converted to bigger hollow points because it just bothered me a little bit flattening them out, although I'm sure that they would work perfectly well flattened out too. Before I go into the accuracy testing of various rounds, I do want to mention that there are a couple of other tools on the market for modifying 22 rounds. Forrester makes an attachment for their trimmers to drill out the hollow points. I mentioned the Paco Kelly tool earlier, and there is a fellow who makes a set of reloading dies, or dies for reloading presses, that form several different bullet tips, and his dies are quite spendy. There's also a few sets offered around the Precision Rimfire group, but these mostly focus on accuracy, although they do flatten the nose of the bullet, which would make it better for hunting. I also got to thinking a fellow could use a lubricizer like a Lyman 450 with a .223 sizing die and a top punch that fit over the rim and hits the die to protect the rim and feed the cartridges into the die nose first, and be able to use the depth adjustment to set how much the nose of the cartridge was flattened. Going into the accuracy testing, I wanted to test several different ammo stock and modified, but I chose the old Federal Bulk Pack 36 grain copper plated hollow points to take things a little bit further. I decided to modify a handful of the cartridges with a number one Phillips bit, and to file a flat nose onto some of the others for to compare the accuracy of these rounds, as well as rounds modified with all three punches that came with the little gizzy. Most accuracy testing was done at 50 yards with my Zestava CZ99 top of the 7 Power Vortex, but I did do some practical accuracy testing with that 25 yards with my Browning BL-22, as well as some accuracy testing with my FN-502 topped with a Vortex Red Dot. Real quick here, I don't think I made a note of this in the podcast, with the ones I modified with the number one Phillips bit, I modified a impact driver bit to fit the die, so that way I could set it. Now, they'll self-center in the hollow point, but it just makes it a little bit easier to hold everything. And then I just used it doesn't have a shelf on it to stop with washers, so I just tried to use consistent hammer blows on those. But I did build a tool to fit in the die to make life a little bit easier. But if you're careful, you can the Phillips will self-center in the hollow points. You can just give them little taps up on the bench and modify them that way. Unfortunately, I ended up not getting as much time this week as I wanted to fully test every type of ammo I wanted. I modified about 10 different kinds of ammo, and I had plans to run several tests with several guns, but just ran out of time. The limited testing I did showed accuracy improvement with the small hole point punch and the flat nose punch. However, although average group size never exceeded the average group size of factory rounds, the large hollow point pin made hardly any noticeable accuracy gains. I did get to run the plain old Federal Bulk 36 grain hollow point through the Zastava, modified 5 different ways, and stock, and got the data from those rounds. These groups were fired at 50 yards, fired off of a rest from the Zastava rifle. In the factory form, the average of five shot groups measured 0.618 inches, with the largest group being 0.648 and the smallest 0.600. Next up with my old filed hollow points like I made with a kid where I just filed the flats top, I found a quarter inch drive socket that I drilled the center out of a little bit, and it was just the right length to take a couple strokes off with a raker file. This ammo group marginally better with the average of 0.624 inch for 5 groups. So apparently I did make a note of this in the episode, so you guys will have to bear with me giving this information again, because I'm just going to go ahead and read it off. Next up, I actually did make a punch to fit the die to make slightly more consistent ammo using a number 1 Phillips bit. As a kid, I would just let the hollow point center the bit and give it a light rap with a hammer. With the modified bit to fit the die snugly, I was able to produce more accurate results. However, the punch does not have a stop on it, so I still had to rely on consistent hammer taps to get uniform ammo. However, this ammo showed promise shooting an average group size of 0.334 inch, with the smallest group overall out of all modified ammo tested at shooting a group of 0.210 inch for 5 shots at 50 yards. And the largest group was 0.426. This modified round actually gave the best average group size and the best overall group. However, average group size was only 1,000 smaller than the next best, which was the small hollow point. The small hollow point pin, which is still a significant hollow point versus stock, gave me an average group size of 0.335 inches, with the best 5-shot group measuring 0.262 inches. Both the modified number 1 punch and the small hollow point punch produced average groups nearly half the size of the factory ammo. And remember that this is cheap bulk ammo, not match grade stuff, that we are now shooting 0.5 MOA groups with. Next up in line for accuracy was the flat nose punch. The factory hollow point on the Federal Bulk is so tiny it nearly vanishes when knocking these out to flat nose. This round also showed great accuracy improvement, with the average of 5 groups being 0.397 and the largest group being 0.498, keeping it under 1 MOA. The smallest group with the flat nose mod was 0.235, which is just a hair over 0.5 MOA, which is really good for a rimfire in my opinion with cheap ammo. Last up is the large hollow point mod. This ammo showed marginal gains in all the ammo I tested. However, in none of my tests did the ammo exceed factory average group size. With the Federal Bulk, the average of 5 5-shot groups measured 0.520 versus the 0.618 factory average. However, out of 5 groups fired, only one of those groups fell under that 1 MOA I was hoping for at 0.408. At 50 yards, most of the modified loads showed great improvement. I had really wanted to stretch this out to 100 yards, but unfortunately I just ran out of time this week. One of the loads I did test that I was really curious to see how accuracy would gain was the CCI Stinger. I like the Stinger rounds, however they are not known for high accuracy. I modified the Stingers with the smaller hollow point punch. I measured the existing hollow point on a Stinger round and it was 0.055 inch. The modified rounds measure 0.107 inches, so nearly double, and also deeper. This batch of Stingers was the 22 Plinkster stuff in the 100 round boxes, but I imagine it is the same as regular Stingers, other than the fancy head stamp. At 50 yards from the Zastava rifle, I got an average of 5 groups with the factory Stinger of 0.492 inch, with 0.446 inch being the smallest. With the modified Stingers, the average dropped down to 0.402 inch, with the smallest group being 0.308. Not a huge difference, but noticeable on paper. Unfortunately, I was not really able to test the expansion on the modified hollow point rounds. I tried shooting into a few different media types with no real luck recovering the bullets. However, the ones I did recover all expanded nicely. I recovered a CCI subsonic modified to the small hollow point pin from a couple of milk jugs filled with water, and it produced a very nice, fully rolled mushroom that measured 0.388 at the widest point, which is a pretty impressive mushroom for a 40-grain bullet that started out at a chronographed 1,028 feet per second. Before we get off the subject of the modified 22 ammo, I want to talk about reloading 22 for just a second. This is something I have never played with, but I mentioned before that my dad has. They make little kits to reload fired 22 cases that come with the little bullet mold and all that. However, prime 22 cases are available online for pretty cheap. This is the route that he went with his 22 reloads. And I mentioned he used standard 22 caliber cast bullets, powder coated, and then crimped onto the gas check shank. I believe he was using 45 grain bullets, and he said that he noticed significant accuracy increases using powders that filled the case, and that overall accuracy was much better than factory ammo that he shot out of his single shot Stevens rifle. However, I can guarantee that his factory test ammo was the cheapest stuff he could get his hands on. And I believe he's shooting iron sights at 100 yards. And at nearly 70 years old, I'm not sure that he performed the most scientific testing. I do know that some of the precision shooting guys do load their own 22 ammo using these empty prime cases and higher BC bullets, but I haven't looked into that too much. I think Dad recently just got a dedicated 22 bullet mold and plans to offer the bullets for sale. However, I am not patient enough to load 22 ammo when it is still fairly easy to get right now and fairly cheap. And even if I wanted to, I can't get the prime cases up here. And regular 22 ammo has enough misfires. I'm not messing with trying to prime it with match heads or whatever they use to reprime them in those kits. One other thing I have played with in the past is using 22 power loads, which are blanks designed for special nail guns, and I use those to shoot 22 caliber pellets. These power loads are readily available at hardware stores in different power levels. It's been a while since I played with this, but I was using a 22 revolver and seating the pellets into the cylinder and then dropping the blanks in behind them. These loads were not very accurate, but shot crazy fast and would penetrate through steel barriers like old car doors and dumpsters that regular 22 ammo would only dent. I want to say the velocity on these was around 2,000 feet per second, but it's been a long time and I can't remember off the top of my head. However, I don't really recommend doing this as it's probably not the safest, and you have to be careful not to get airspace between the back of the pellet and the front of the cartridge. If you do play with it, just remember that I told you not to, and don't come crying to me if it goes badly. Anyway, before I get this section wrapped up, I do want to say that I'm very impressed with this little Gizzy tool, and I recommend it. The price on the tool is around $80, and they can be found on eBay. Someone handy with a lathe could make something similar quite easily, and I also think, I mentioned that using a lubricizer with 0.223 dye, I think could be made to work the same way also. There's also a fellow named Neil Waltz. I mentioned before the dye makers that make the dyes for the reloading press, and that's the guy. They have a built-in depth adjustment, and I think it'd be much more adjustment, and it'd be much more uniform and consistent than what I'm doing, even with the washers. And I'd love to get my hand on one of his tools, but they are not cheap, and he's very hard to get a hold of it because he has virtually no online presence. However, I did manage to get my hands on his contact info, and I've talked to him about his tools, and they are about $100 more than the little Gizzy. Walt is a retired toolmaker, and from what I've read on the Rimfire forums, his tools are top shelf, and I plan on trying to get one of his someday, but it won't be anytime soon. Do I think modifying the 22 ammo is worth it? Yes. Especially in times like these when sometimes you can't get the ammo you want. Modifying round nose ammo to flat nose makes the ammo much more effective for hunting, and the hollow point rounds are also make good improvements, and added accuracy is a bonus. Am I going to modify every 22 round I shoot from now on? No way. But I still feel like this tool will see quite a bit of use modifying hunting ammo, and I feel like the investment was worth it overall, even if for no other reason than just the learning factor. I was originally going to save this review for next week since the main topic of this week was originally going to be the gear review for this week. However, since it's 22 related, I decided to go ahead and just put it on this show. When Federal first announced the Punch 22 ammo, I got excited when I saw the flat nose on this ammo, thinking it would be a great option for hunting ammo. I was disappointed to learn that they use a 29 grain bullet, which essentially makes it a souped up 22 long, with an advertised velocity of 1,070 feet per second from a 2-inch barrel. However, I like the Stingers that use the 32 grain bullet, so I figured I'd try a couple boxes. I tested this ammo out of two semi-auto pistols, my Browning BL-22, and did bench accuracy testing with my Zastava 99. First off, let's talk about this advertised velocity. I tested this ammo from a Beretta 21A, which has a 2.4-inch barrel and is a sealed breech, and my FN-502 with its 4.6-inch barrel, and my Browning BL-22 with a 20-inch barrel. There's no cylinder gap on any of these guns to lose pressure, like you would with a revolver. From the 21A, average velocity was 959 feet per second, so a little bit short of their advertised 2-inch barrel velocity. I compared Stinger velocity as well from all three platforms. In the Beretta 29A, the Stingers produced 929 feet per second velocity average, but because of the extra bullet weight, this equates to 2 foot-pounds more energy. And I know it's not enough to matter, but it's just making the point here that usually the heavier bullets produce better muzzle energy. Out of the 2.4-inch barrel, the highest muzzle energy produced from the loads I tested actually came from the 36-grain CCI mini mag hollow points, producing 885 foot per second average velocity, but producing 63 foot-pounds of energy versus the 59 foot-pounds of energy of the Federal Punch ammo. From the longer barrel of the FN-502, we see the velocity jump up to 1,166 foot per second and 88 foot-pounds of energy. The Stingers from this gun produce 1,188 foot per second and 100 foot-pounds of energy, which is a pretty good jump over the Punch ammo. From the 20-inch rifle barrels, we again see a jump in velocity with the Punch to 1,431 feet per second and 132 foot-pounds of energy. However, the heavier Stinger once again wins the energy contest with 138 foot-pounds of energy at 1,385 feet per second. Before we get into the accuracy results, I should mention that this ammo failed to cycle the Beretta 21A 100% of the time, and the FN-502 about 50% of the time. The 21A does not have an extractor and relies on the back pressure of the cartridge to cycle the action. And the cases failed to leave the chamber, so I had to tip the barrel up and manually extract them for each shot. The FN wouldn't kick back hard enough to fully eject the cases, resulting in either stovepipes or just leaving the empties in the chamber, or a couple times kicking the empty out but not picking up a fresh cartridge. At first, I thought this might have to do with the longer case on the Punch ammo, but the Stingers used the same longer case, and they cycled both guns perfectly. Lastly, on the accuracy, I fired 5 5-shot groups at 50 yards, producing an average group size of 0.449 inches. Not terrible, but the Zastava will consistently put decent ammo into 0.2 to 0.3-inch groups at that range. Overall, I'm not very impressed with this ammo, especially since it's marketed as a self-defense round. I'm sure it would work fine in a revolver, but I would test to make sure that it's actually worth the extra cost, since a box of 50 costs more than a box of 100 of the mini mags, and for my 21A, the mini mags perform better on every level. If you are going to run it in an auto gun, run at least 5 boxes through it and make sure it cycles the gun reliably, because it did not run any of my semi-autos reliably. Alright guys, well that pretty much wraps it up for this week's show. I appreciate everybody taking the time to listen. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at dansgunstuff@gmail.com. You can also find me on most social media platforms as The Shooter's Apprentice, and there is a Facebook page for the show called The Mountain Man Dan Show on Facebook. Feel free to send in any comments or ideas for future shows. So far, the feedback on the show has been great. If you guys could tell your friends about the show and also share a link on your social media, that would greatly help with trying to grow the audience. Also, be sure to drop a rating on the show on whatever platform you listen to it on, so that'll also help the show grow. Growing the show means I'll have more resources to work with to keep doing the show better and better. Anyway, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this one up. Thanks again, and until next time, stay safe out there, and don't shoot yourself in the foot.
Same nail too long. My ears can't stand to hear the same old song. And I don't leave the highway long enough to bog down in the mud. 'Cause I've got rambling fever in my blood. I caught this rambling fever. About when I